Natasha Mitchell joining you for All in the Mind with the final in our 10th birthday celebrations. And in our 10th year, we're also trying something new, always good to do. Next week, Mind Meets Body. And we're swapping with a new series from Amanda Smith called The Body Sphere, which will be in a new slot of Sundays at 5 and still on Mondays at 1. And then All in the Mind will return as a season as well from April in the same slot. Presented by Lynn Malcolm. I'm heading off to present Life Matters for a Change. For podcast fans, join me over there. Lots of crossover themes with All in the Mind, you'll be pleased to hear, and all podcasts too. It's been a real delight to start this show on ABC Radio National back in 2002. Not the least because I got to interview folk like today's guest. Acclaimed neuroscientist Professor Vilinor Ramachandran from the University of California, San Diego, joined me on the show back in 2005. Richard Dawkins has described him as a latter-day Marco Polo, journeying the Silk Road of science to strange and exotic cafes of the mind. And so I started by asking Ramachandran if that's what doing brain research feels like at the turn of the 21st century.
It does indeed. I mean, I always tell some of my colleagues it's great fun because it's like being in Victorian England, where you're still discovering the lay of the land. And imagine all of these scholars bringing exotic animals like giraffes back from distant lands to London and people gawking at them, and Michael Faraday taking a little piece of magnet, moving to and fro in a coil and generating an electric current, thereby linking two completely different, seemingly unrelated fields, electricity and magnetism. So people are just doing tinkering and having a lot of fun, but discovering amazing things. And I think neuroscience, especially cognitive neuroscience, is at that stage now. It's at the Faraday stage, which is the most exciting stage in the history of any science.
But look, I've been interested to read one of your compatriots, neuroscientist Stephen Rose's new book called The 21st Century Brain.
Yes, I heard it's very good. And in fact, they sent it to me to blurb, but I was doing something.
Too busy. Look, he charts what is really the extraordinary momentum that the brain sciences have gathered over the last 20 years. But look, he's worried too, because he has a sense that neuroscience is trying to create a theory of everything that it simply isn't qualified to offer. You know, he's worried about reductionist explanations of human nature. Do you share his concern?
There are two problems which are sometimes confounded. One is if you reduce everything to neurons, like falling in love or ambition or pride or joy or the self, my God, does that mean there's no love? And that's a fallacy because, you know, explaining something doesn't mean you explain it away. So, for example, if you're making, supposing two people are making love and a crazy scientist comes along and says, look, this is just neurons in the septum, neurons in the hypothalamic nuclei. These are all the neurons that are firing away. That's all there is to it. And then the lover turns to his girlfriend and says, you mean that's it? It's just chemicals? Is neurons firing away? You're not really in love? She could then argue, no, on the contrary, this proves it's all real. that I'm not faking it. Look at the pattern of activity. It shows it's real. Just to emphasize that when you explain something in terms of component parts, you enrich your understanding of it. You certainly don't diminish from the experience or detract from the experience. That fear is not justified. The other deeper fear, which I think may be justified, is that a time will surely come, say 500 years from now, maybe earlier, that when you can create the brain in the vat scenario that philosophers often talk about. I can take your brain before it starts degenerating, before you die, before you become old, put it in a vat with a culture medium, supply oxygen, stimulate all the right patterns of neural activity so you can be whoever you want to be. You can be a combination of Bill Gates and Einstein and some Olympic athlete, whoever you want to be.
The disembodied self.
But still be you, okay? I can arrange that. And there's nothing in science that forbids this. All neuroscientists would predict that this is going to happen someday, right? Now, people often quibble about you can't get it exactly right, but that doesn't matter, you know. But now, if I give you a choice, you can have this vat, or you can be the brain in the vat, or you can be who you are. Most people pick the latter. They say, oh, I'd rather be who I am. I don't want to be the brain in the vat, even though it sounds good. But there's no way you can logically justify that. You have to bring in religion or faith or something like that. You can't logically defend your choice of the real you, the real brain. Because if you think about it, you are a brain in a vat. The vat is called the cranial vault. The culture medium is called the cerebrospinal fluid. and you're supplying oxygen and nutrition. And instead of stimulating with electrodes, I'm stimulating it with photons. You look around the world. Okay, it's just different kinds of energy interacting. So all I'm doing is asking you to choose between two vats. So that's going to be a serious dilemma, and there I would agree with Stephen Rose. You and I don't have to worry about it, but it will be a problem a few hundred years from now.
We're expecting to see a new book from you down the track in Australia called The Artful Brain, and you're certainly well known for brave and creative hypothesising, always a good skill in the sciences. But tell me, what motivated you as a neuroscientist to take on perhaps one of the wiliest questions of all, and that is, what is art?
Well, you know, I was on a sabbatical in India about 7 or 8 years ago, and seeing patients in the hospital. And there was a dry spell, not that many patients. So I was walking around the temples looking at Indian art. And when I was raised on these religious icons, these sculptures. And then when I went to the West, I was trained in a tradition of Western art. So, but suddenly there was an epiphany, and I started looking at these. It started haunting me day and night. And I suddenly began to see their beauty as great works of art, independent of mythology or religious connotations. So then I started asking, are there artistic universals? Despite the staggering diversity of artistic styles you see across the planet, you know, there is cubism, there is impressionism, expressionism, classical Greek art, Renaissance art. In spite of all this diversity, could there be some common principles that cut across cultural boundaries? Then I came across the Australian bowerbirds.
Ah.
And then I said, my God, they're creating these amazingly beautiful bowers. The male bowerbird is a drab little fellow. But as a sort of Freudian compensation, he creates these amazing bachelor pads, which have got archways, lawns, and he decorates them with little berries, certain colored berries grouped into the red berries in one group, blueberries in another group. There is symmetry, there is grouping, there is color contrast. All the aesthetic principles which we deploy in our art, here's a bird brain deploying the same principles. So not only are there aesthetic principles across cultures, maybe even across phylogenetic lines, across species. That's what I tell some of the art historians who start arguing with me about how can there be artistic universals.
It is a controversial question, though, isn't it? It's in a sense, they would argue that art is a celebration of human individuality and the human creative spirit.
Yes, but
in
that
all
doesn't
its diversity.
Deny... Sure, but that doesn't deny the existence of universals. I mean, you can have universal principles, but the manner in which an individual artist deploys those principles is entirely up to him or her. And that's where his intuition, his genius comes to play. And of course, cultural factors play a tremendous role in the emergence of art. Otherwise, you wouldn't have different types of art. You wouldn't have Renaissance art, Indian art, Tibetan art. But we already know that, and that's what art historians spend their time doing. They study the variations imposed by culture. But there are very few people studying aesthetic universals. Let's not call it art because it's a loaded word, but aesthetic universals. And that's what I'm doing, and some of my colleagues, Marge Livingston, Samir Zeki, are also doing.
By looking for universals, you're suggesting there may be some common biological or neurological bases to all aesthetic experience.
Absolutely.
And creation.
And absolutely. And one of the ideas I've tried to push, there's two main ideas. One is, I think Western representational art is an anomaly. Because if you look at the entire history of the human species, most of the art is highly distorted, exaggerated, even abstract. I mean, look at cave art. These are all very exaggerated caricatures of bison. With teeny-weeny heads, huge humps. They don't look like real bison. And this is true of African art, which looks more like cubism than representational art. And in fact, was the inspiration for cubism. Look at much of Indian art. Look at Chola bronzes. Look at Mughal miniatures. Emphasis is on play, whimsical play of colors. Then I come here to Australia and I look at the Aborigine indigenous art. And it really zaps me. It hits me in the eye, even though I never had much exposure to it in the past. And here's evidence, if I need any, that art has universal appeal. Here's a culture that has evolved almost independently for thousands of years. And yet this art appeals to me instantly because they're using the same principles such as grouping and what I call peak shift. So just to give you an example of the kind of law artistic universals I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
One would be the example, what I call the gull-chick beak principle.
Oh, this is the chick, the beak, and the sticks. Tell me this one.
Yes, that it's all about attracting chicks, okay? So what it is ethologists have shown, as soon as the seagull chick hatches, it starts pecking at the mother's beak for food. And the mother seagull's beak is a long yellow thing with a red spot. And it starts pecking, and the mother then regurgitates half-digested food into the gaping mouth of the chick. The chick swallows it, and it's happy. Question is, how does the chick, why does it get excited when it looks at the mother? How does it recognize its mother? They found, and I'm talking about Tim Bergen's work here, you don't need a mother. You can pluck the beak away and just wave the beak in front of the chick, and the chick gets excited and starts pecking at the beak, the disembodied beak. Now, that's interesting. And what it's telling you is that nature is taking shortcuts. In evolution, through millions of years, the chick's brain, its tectum and hypostriatum and other visual areas, have learned the only time I'm going to see a long thing with a red spot in nature is when there's my mother is attached to it.
And there's food.
I'm not going to see a mutant pig with a beak or a malicious ethologist waving a beak, okay? Anytime it sees a long thing with a red spot, my God, it's a beak, let me beg for food, okay? Now you say, what's that got to do with art? I'm getting there.
Okay? I was about to ask that.
Okay. Now, it turns out you don't even need a beak with a spot. You can take a long yellow stick with a red spot, and the chick will peck at that yellow stick with a red spot. Now, you've got a visual illusion here. That's good enough to titillate the neurons, the beak-detecting neurons in the brain, and to fool the chick into thinking it's looking at a beak, okay? But now here's the punchline. What Tim Bergen found was, quite by accident, you can have a long, thin stick with three red stripes, and the chick goes berserk. It prefers this fetishized, highly abstract representation of a beak to the real beak, right?
So it's an exaggerated form of that original beak.
And it's not even exaggerated in any obvious way. Mm. It's actually what I call a hypernormal stimulus, a super beak. And why three stripes? We don't know. It may be that the neurons have certain coding parameters, which we don't quite understand yet. And what you're doing by having a long stick with three red stripes is hyperactivating those beak-detecting neurons. So it, to the chick's brain, it looks more beak-like than a real beak.
And this is what you call the peak shift effect, which actually dribbles into all artistic expression,
Correct. So the argument is, this is what, if the seagulls had an art gallery, they would hang this long stick with the three red stripes on the wall. They would worship it, call it a Picasso, pay millions of dollars for it, but not understand why, because it says it doesn't resemble anything. Why am I mesmerized? So I'm saying that Picasso, Klimt, Henry Moore, all of these artists, through trial and error, through intuition, through genius, have stumbled on the figural primitives and color primitives of human vision and have created for us the equivalent of the long stick with the three red stripes for the gull chick's brain. So you go, wow, and you're mesmerized like I did the other day at the local art galleries looking at indigenous art, but I can't figure out why because it doesn't resemble anything. So I think Western representational art, in fact, is an anomaly in the history of art. So-called primitive art, whether it's primitive African art, which provided the inspiration for Cubism, and maybe many indigenous tribal arts throughout the world, pre-Columbian art, Indian art, all of these are, in fact, more real than so-called realistic art.
And on ABC Radio National's All in the Mind with me, Natasha Mitchell, for our 10th birthday celebration, an interview I did with the provocative neuroscientist Professor V.S. Ramachandran back in 2005. Now, he calls art visual foreplay before the climax of recognition. Keep that in mind next time you visit the art gallery. And he thinks aesthetic experiences are about generating as many aha moments in the brain as possible.
And I think that's right on target. I may be wrong, but it's a hypothesis. And what I'm arguing is, you see, there is this model, very silly model of the brain that comes mainly from MIT, from Fodor and David Marr and others. It's called the hierarchical serial bucket brigade model of vision, that you compute something early in vision, right? So you're looking at a telephone or looking at a person's face or anything. You do a primitive analysis of the image initially. Then you send the output to a second module, which do a more sophisticated analysis, then to a third module, and then to a fourth module. Finally, you recognize the object, and you say, aha! And you send a jolt to the emotional centers and say, that's a telephone. And I'm saying that's not how vision works. At each stage in the processing, there is a mini-aha when you recognize a partial object-like entity. And you then send a signal to the limbic system saying, hey, there's something potentially object-like here. Pay attention. Maybe it is an object. Then you say, oh, my God, if I group these fragments, I'm starting to see an outline. Pay even more attention. Aha. Look, it looks like a big blob in this corner. Aha. my God, it's a lion, let me get out of here.
This is, in a sense, tapping into the fact that our brains evolved in highly camouflaged environments. And in a sense, we're constantly probing our visual world, searching for meaning.
That's correct. And all the, every early stage in vision involved in segmentation of objects and discovering objects in a camouflaged environment is associated with its own mini aha. And the jolt comes back, prompts a further search for object-like entities. And what the artist does is create as many of these ahas to more optimally titillate the visual centers in your brain and the accompanying limbic reward than you can by looking at a natural object. So that's why I call art visual foreplay before the final climax of object recognition.
It's interesting, and it's amazing to think that artists do all this without even really knowing they're doing it. Art, you are suggesting there, exploits what is really a close wiring between the visual parts of our brains and the emotional parts of our brains. And in fact, you've done some fascinating work with different patients for whom that connection is compromised in some way. Can you give me some examples there?
Well, we haven't specifically worked on patients' reactions to art, but I can tell you that there are patients with epileptic seizures who we think have a process called kindling, where the sensory input and its links to the emotional limbic core of the brain are heightened. And this may give them a heightened appreciation of color space or a heightened appreciation of form. And some of these people suddenly start writing poetry, or in the case of Van Gogh, producing beautiful, colorful paintings. And I think his epileptic seizures may have actually contributed to his empathy for color and his ability to portray these gorgeous colors in his paintings.
Mm.
And also there are people with what we call Capgras syndrome who have a disconnection between vision and emotion. So things they look at don't evoke emotions anymore. And we have had people say that things which used to be pretty, or like flowers, are no longer a bit bland, are no longer pretty. And therefore, you may be seeing a derangement in these very connections, which I'm talking about, which are involved in producing those multiple mini ahas, creating aesthetic experience.
But of course, people with Capgras delusion don't just stop appreciating art, perhaps, emotionally, so to speak. They also stop appreciating their family.
That's correct. It's one of the most extraordinary things about that syndrome is they'll say the mother, the patient will look at his mother and will tell you with a perfectly straight face, this is not my mother, she's some other woman pretending to be my mother. And again, this chap may be quite normal in every other respect. You know, he's fluent in conversation, he's attentive, he's alert, he's intelligent. Everything seems fine except for this one very circumscribed delusion that his mother is an imposter. And we think that's because the limbic connection is deranged. So when he looks at his mother, there is no emotional arousal. So the only way he can rationalize this is to say, if this is my mother, why don't I experience any warmth or terror, as the case may be? And so this must be some other woman who's not my mother. And we've actually measured their galvanic skin response and shown that something like this does indeed happen. And by the way, going back to art briefly, there are some researchers who have argued, look, you find a cell in the brain that responds to something, then that helps you explain art. Now, I am not saying that, but I think that a more sophisticated theory, not just saying here's a neuron that fires when you show it a picture, but asking what parameters of the image the artist is focusing on, is exaggerating, is amplifying to elicit a greater aha jolt in the visual centers in the brain. And one of my laws, by the way, is what I call visual problem solving, perceptual problem solving. So if a nude seen behind a diaphanous veil or through a fog is more alluring, paradoxically, than a pinup. Now, why would that be? You know, there's actually less information if you think about it.
Not sure that everyone would agree with you there, but yep, go on.
Well, in a lot of art, you find this sort of element of puzzle solving. You know, the object is partially hidden rather than made completely explicit.
The sort of visual peekaboo, you call
Visual peekaboo principle, as I call it. And the reason for that is you have to make it pleasurable. You need to send an aha to the limbic structures saying, look, there is something partially hidden here. Look deeper. Just as intellectual problem solving is pleasurable long before you solve it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be scientists. And there's miles and miles of frustration before you hit the jackpot, right?
Mm.
So what keeps us going is there are mini ahas all along the way. And I think that's equally true in visual problem solving and visual art.
Now look, the other thing is metaphor is core to art and the artistic experience as well, and you've even contemplated a neurological basis for metaphor in your own work with extraordinary patients. Where have you gone searching? Which patients have helped you out there?
We've been interested in metaphor because of a condition called synesthesia, where people get their senses muddled up. You know, red, C-sharp is red. The tone C-sharp is red. Every time they hear C-sharp is red.
They experience redness.
Mm. And people used to think they were just crazy. And what our group showed was, we did a number of experiments, psychophysical experiments, perceptual experiments, and brain imaging experiments. And what we have shown is that, in fact, this is a genuine sensory perceptual effect happening early in the brain because of cross-wiring, sometimes cross-activation between, say, the tone area and the color area, or sometimes numbers are colored. 5 is red, 6 is blue, 7 is green. And the number area and color area in the brain are right next to each other in the fusiform gyrus. And we have now done brain imaging experiments. There's a paper out in the journal Neuron showing that in normal people, when you show numbers, only the number area lights up in the fusiform gyrus. In synesthetes, both the number area and the color area lights up. There's spillover or cross-activation of the color region occurring every time this chap sees a black and white number or letter. Now, that's just associations, but we took this step further. You can take this a step further to talk about metaphor, which again is an example of cross-activation between seemingly unrelated conceptual domains. We've seen patients with damage to a structure called the angular gyrus in the left hemisphere. This gyrus is lying at the crossroads between frontal, temporal, and parietal lobes of the brain. And it's enormous in humans, much bigger than in other primates.
Mm.
And when it's damaged, what we find is we now have 5 patients damaged to the left angular gyrus. They're abysmal with metaphor. But in these people, if you tell them all that glitters is not gold, he says, well, you know, if there's a shiny metal, piece of metal, it doesn't mean it's gold. It could be copper. It could be some alloy. Okay. Then you say, I know that, but is there any other meaning beyond that?
So he doesn't get the metaphor.
No. He says, oh, yeah, well, there is a deeper meaning. It means if you go to a jewelry shop, you'd be very careful because they might trick you, because they might give you something else and call it gold. So they completely miss the point of the metaphor. They're not stupid because they'll give you long-winded, elaborate, often ingenious interpretation of the metaphor or proverb, but completely off the mark. A bit like people who review my grant proposals, I might add. So this is extraordinary because it suggests that the angular gyrus of the brain is the quote-unquote metaphor center. And I'm not going to, you know, call it that. That's an overstatement. But it's critically involved in our ability, the human ability, to form, to engage in metaphorical thinking. And also, there's another gyrus just above it called the supramarginal gyrus, which is involved in complex skilled actions. So a chap with damage to this area in the left hemisphere has problems with skilled action. If you tell him, here's a chap who's intelligent, who can understand what you're saying, he talks to you about politics, everything seems fine, until you say, hammer a nail, he'll just flail his arm on the table. Comb your hair, he just bangs his head, as unable to pretend he's combing his hair. Okay? But what's new is we find some of these patients don't understand embodied action metaphors. If you tell them, what do you mean by get a grip on yourself? The chap starts gripping his own body with his hand.
So they take it literally.
They take it completely literally.
Your sense, I guess people with synesthesia, back to the, them for example, have a sort of heightened ability to create or generate or experience metaphor.
Absolutely.
And your sense is that their unusual capacity has bigger implications. They might even offer a window into the nature of thought of language in all our brains.
That is correct. I mean, I as I mentioned in the Deakin lecture the other day, it turns out that I just explained that synesthesia was caused by cross-activation. This could be actual wires, new wires, which do exist in them, which don't exist in us, people who are not gifted, who don't have synesthesia. Or it could be disinhibition of pre-existing connections, right? Now, why does this happen? Why does a cross-activation happen? It turns out synesthesia runs in families, so there may be a gene mutation that causes excess connections between adjacent brain regions. Why would that be? Well, it turns out all of us are born with excess connections connecting everything to everything in the brain. I mean, that's an overstatement.
And they get pruned as we grow.
And then they get pruned to create the modules in the adult brain. Now, if that pruning gene is defective, or the gene that allows inhibitory insulation between adjacent brain regions is defective, then you're going to get spontaneous cross-activation, or cross-wiring between number and color.
But your suggestion
if the gene is selectively expressed in the fusiform, you get this quirk called number-color synesthesia. But now, what if the gene were expressed everywhere? Now, here comes the punchline. It turns out synesthesia is 8 times more common among artists, poets, and novelists. And this is something that we have also confirmed in our lab, but nobody knew why, and nobody even suggested why this might be. We're suggesting if the same gene is expressed throughout the brain, instead of just in the fusiform gyrus, you're going to get a more cross-wired brain. You're going to get a greater propensity towards metaphorical thinking, linking seemingly unrelated conceptual realms. Like when you say it is the east and Juliet is the sun. Okay, Juliet is
clearly
radiant,
not the,
like
sun.
The sun.
That's right, yeah. But your suggestion is, in fact, we're all closet synesthetes to an extent.
To an extent, we were all actual synesthetes as children, and we retained residual synesthetic propensities as adult. And this gene varies in the population, in its frequency, and there are some outliers who have more synesthesia than others, and they are the ones we call artistic types, people who are artistic or poetic, or people who are creative in the sciences. Now, somebody asked me the other day, well, how come if this gene is so good and makes us all creative, how come we don't all have it?
And it's not a single gene, necessarily, we should point out.
Not necessarily a single gene, maybe a small subset of them. But the reason we don't all have it, well, first of all, evolution takes time. Maybe one day we will all have it, and that'll be a good thing. And secondly, it may not be a good thing for everybody to be poetic and artistic. If you have a neurosurgeon doing surgery on your brain, you don't want a creative neurosurgeon. You want them to stick to the, okay?
Well, they need to be creative within their bounds, don't they?
Exactly. You want some people to think outside, some outliers who are creative, and that's why the gene has the frequency that it does.
Rama, your work is always rich for discussion, and I thank you very much for being my guest this week on the program. The ever-passionate neuroscientist, Professor Vilinor Ramachandran, Director of the Centre for Brain and Cognition at UC San Diego. Look out for his books, always worth a read. And look, the whole field of neuroaesthetics, as it's described today, has totally exploded since that interview first went to air in 2005. Search your archives for stories on that. Now, next week, let me explain what's happening with All in the Mind and Me. 10 years feels to me like a nice round figure for a change, and so I'm looking forward to catching you now every weekday morning from 9 a.m. for Life Matters, which if you're used to joining me via podcast, you can do that with Life Matters as well. Lots of lovely crossover themes with All in the Mind, but a much vaster brief, so really more for me to play with you. Now, All in the Mind will be swapping seasonally with an exciting new show, The Body Sphere, presented by Amanda Smith here on ABC Radio National. Amanda, who joins me now, the body meets mind.
Exactly. The mind-body split occurs on Radio National, Tash.
Look, do you think it's a split?
Because no, of course not. I mean, it's
Descartes,
a continuum.
I've just put all this work into trying to bring them all together. I reckon this is a really exciting opportunity.
Yes, and we can just focus in these seasons for 12 weeks on the life of the body and 12 weeks the life of the mind with the body sphere and All in the Mind. Can I just say, too, happy 10 years of All in the Mind and congratulations. And I so look forward to listening to you on Life Matters as well.
Thanks, love. Now, the body is such an interesting place to occupy because the thing about the mind, and I think the body too, is that it's the most delicious play space for a broadcaster. It's so interdisciplinary.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing that I love about the idea of doing this program. You know, I can go from sport and exercise and fitness to dance to a whole lot of issues like the fat acceptance movement, the history of dieting, barefoot running, ideas and ideals about beauty, you know, across a whole lot of areas that I think is very interesting and exciting. Not just for me, but I hope for listeners.
So this will all be happening now. We're moving slots to Sundays at 5, mm-hmm. Still on Mondays at 1. So Amanda Smith with The Body Sphere kicks off next weekend. And then in April, All in the Mind returns as a season 2 with Lynn Malcolm in the chair. So it's Body Meets Mind on Radio National in 2012. Thanks so much for a wild ride on the show these past 10 years. Listeners all over the world, great guests, compelling ideas to nut out with you on the radio. Indescribable pleasure and honour. What a gift of a gig. And thanks to the wonderful producers and sound engineers who have contributed to the show over the years too. I've named them all on our Facebook page. Splendid stuff. Signing off for now. Ciao.